history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that we ought to hear. We don't want them to go untold, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Hanford, California, with 97-year-old Russell Brookshire. When he was in the Army Air Corps, some of his buddies called him Scooter, but if you grew up around Hanford, you probably called him Doctor. Maybe he even delivered you. But we're going to go way back before he ever heard of Hanford, California, to his childhood in Burke Burnett, Texas. You want to tell everybody where Burke Burnett, Texas is, and how big that place is?
Burke Burnett is about 90 miles northwest of Fort Worth. Population at the time I lived there was slightly under 3,000 souls. Most of the population was employed the surrounding oil fields and farming.
And you had an older brother?
Had an older brother, 2 years older than I.
So what was that childhood like there? I mean, I've been to that part of the country in August. I know you sweat a lot in the summer and it's very humid, but what was that childhood like in Burke Burnett?
I lived in a happy family home, two blocks from Main Street. My father was an oil field worker. My mother, during the Depression years, had gone to cosmetology school and became a hairdresser and added to the meager earnings of Dad as an oil field worker.
So you could see, even as a young boy, the effects of the Great Depression? You felt some of that?
No, not really, because Mom and Dad stretched their meager earnings, and we had everything that we needed to live. Dad purchased a home that became our family home in town for $1,200. It was home for all my childhood. Prior to that, we lived on a company lease, oil lease, 3 miles from town. It was a company owned and all utilities and rent free. When Dad bought the house and moved into town, it was like a castle to us.
Do you remember in those early years, your school years, having some ideas of what you were going to do someday, what you were going to be when you grew up, or the adventures you might have?
I had dreams of flying. I oftentimes, in the summertime, lay in the grass in the backyard with a friend of mine who later became a pilot also. We'd watch the occasional airplane fly over, and just in our imagination, we envisioned ourselves doing the same up in the air.
What was your first chance to get up in the air? Do you remember your first experience in a plane?
Yes. After graduation in 1940, I enrolled in a junior college at Cameron State College in Oklahoma and enrolled my second year in a government program called CPT, which is Civilian Pilot Training, and flew my first time in the air in that course. And the desire for more knowledge in aviation was inborn from that time.
Do you still remember that feeling? The first time you got in the air, what that felt like, especially when you got to be at the controls?
I never have thought of it. I just wanted more and more.
And what was that? Would that have been a Stearman or a Piper Cub? Or?
It was a two-seated side-by-side Taylor craft, a 65-horse motor.
So I don't want to miss anything either. Your high school days in Burke Burnett, were you playing any sports or anything? I saw a tall, handsome man there.
I ran track. Played a little baseball, did make the team, and played some tennis on the team.
And when you went off to Cameron and you started doing that pilot training and everything, did you have any idea that there was a hint or a possibility of war coming to the U.S.?
Yes. In fact, war was on the horizon, and Britain had been fighting World War II beginning in 1939. The United States, under the Lend-Lease Act, was furnishing munitions and airplanes to Great Britain and the Allies, Russia also. and continued supplying munitions under the Lees-Lind Act. Still, the United States was not in the war. They were just a supplier of wartime equipment. Probably, at that time at least, the United States would not have entered the war until December 41, and the Japanese pushed the United States to declare war against the Japanese and Nazi Germany.
Do you remember where you were and how you found out about that, December 7th, 41? Oh,
absolutely. As a college student, I had a part-time job as an usher in one of the theaters in Lawton, Oklahoma, frequented mostly by the soldiers at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The theater was down in that part of town and ran a lot of the naughty-type movies. I was working, I don't know what time it was in Hawaii, but that was early afternoon in Lawton, and I heard on the radio that the United States had been attacked at Pearl Harbor.
What kind of feelings did that produce in you? Was that a shock? Did it make you angry? Did you think you were going to do something about it? How did you handle that?
I felt very, very strongly about it and decided to join the Air Corps. Probably at that time, the lines became so long at the recruiting station. All the young people wanted a piece of that and kill the Japanese. The feeling was very, very strong, and the whole country was just carried away and making preparations and doing all they could to create a fighting force.
But something else was going on at this time there in Lawton, Oklahoma, because you'd met a special someone there at Cameron?
Yes. I met this little girl from Walters, Oklahoma. Her name was Pensy Ruth Barbee. Prettiest little girl I'd ever seen, and as sweet as she could be. I had desires to acquaint myself with her, and at the time, she was a year behind me in college. Her boyfriend was Sanders Cox. He was a middleweight fighter and rose to some degree of national recognition in the middleweight division later on. But he was Pensy Ruth's boyfriend at the time. He was, at this particular time, he was out on an athletic tour among Oklahoma schools and boxing team. And I thought sure that he was going to pound me into the ground when he came home. But that didn't occur. He thought probably, well, there's more sand on the beach. And so actually, Sanders and I became friends, and for several months we were roommates in the dormitory. I met her. She was the only one in my life from then on.
And I talked to so many veterans who had that dilemma. Should I try to get married before I go overseas in the service, or take the chance that we're both still feeling the same if I come back? Did you guys talk about that at all?
You know, that probably crossed my mind, but it didn't deter me nor her. I was destined to be in the service, and if I did not come back, let's hurry up and get married. Well, we didn't get married for almost three more years after I graduated from flight school. I graduated 5th of January in 43, and we got married on the 20th of February, 44.
Again, I'm thinking about so many other guys I've talked to. Just about everyone I've met who was in the Army Air Corps got in because he wanted to be a pilot. But that actually became reality for very few of the people who enlisted in the Army Air Corps. So you joined in April 42. You had your sights set on being a pilot. Were there some challenges along the way where you saw other guys washed out, or maybe that could have been you, that you had to overcome to become a pilot?
You know, I took to flying like a hog goes for slop. I was in Wonderland. I excelled in everything that I did in the Air Corps, and was rewarded accordingly as time went on, with being selected for a number of activities that are above and beyond the rest of the group.
What were some of the places that they sent you along the way before you got your wings?
Well, due to my previous flight experience in the CPT, when I joined the Air Corps, I had approximately 150 hours in the air. And due to that previous flying experience, I was selected under the Lend-Lease Act that Great Britain had moved all of their primary flight trainees to the United States because of the air over Britain was so dangerous from the Luftwaffe knocking the student pilots out of the air. So all of the RAF was trainees were here in the United States. I was selected to be in a ratio of 17 per 100 RAF cadets in every class. So I was trained in the RAF base that was had been established at Miami, Oklahoma. And instead of the U.S. programs of primary move to secondary move to advanced types of aircraft, the RAF had shortened those periods. We had the primaries and the Fairchild PT-19 aircraft. From there, stayed at the same base, but went to the advanced aircraft, North American AT-6s, with retractable gear, much, much more powerful than the primary. Went all the way through the remainder of the training period in the AT-6. Then the AT-6 graduates primarily were to go to fighter school, single-engine fighter school. I was looking forward to that and wound up being assigned to a four-engine bomber school at Great Falls, Montana. So I flew four engines the rest of my days.
Was that a disappointment to you at the time?
At the time it was.
But now you have a little different perspective?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I had a different idea. I could get up and go wee-wee, and you couldn't do that in a single engine. Get up and I learned to love the four engine. At that time, we were designated to go to England to the 8th Air Force. I had slightly over 100 hours flying time in the B-17, and the mission was changed. Instead of going to the 8th Air Force in England, I went to the CBI Theater at B-24s. Well, 17s and the 24s. It's like Ford and Chevrolet. Some people liked one and more or less spit on the other, but I loved the old 24 because it brought me home so many times.
Yeah, 78 missions. And you said it's CBI, China, Burma, India. And, you know, so often this is a forgotten part of World War II because we hear so much about Europe and the landings and the air war there and the naval battles and all the amphibious landings in the Pacific. But there's a huge amount of territory in China, Burma, and India, and some of the most dangerous situations that Americans faced, some of them even before America was actually in the war, when you go back to General Chenault and his Flying Tigers and all of that. How often do you run into people who have a puzzled look when you tell them where you served in World War II?
Some of them don't have any knowledge at all of that part of the world during the war.
So I'm sure you set them straight, right? You help them understand why it was significant?
Tried.
Well, here's your opportunity now. But I'm interested. Well, I guess I should ask first, when did you head overseas?
In September of 44.
So you got married right before that?
Mm-hmm. In February.
So you're married, and now you're heading overseas. Do you think you're going to see your wife again, or are you sure about that?
You know, I didn't think on that side of the equation at all. I'm going over and whip those Japanese, not having any idea of the task, really.
Well, I'm sure you're going to help us understand the task. I've talked to some guys who, you know, maybe it was a wife, it was a girlfriend, but some of them would carry that little photo in their pocket of their uniform, or they'd put it somewhere up on the, you know, in the cockpit. Did you have some way of keeping her in mind while you're over there?
I did not have a photo of her in the cockpit. Many, many times during a mission, I wondered if I would ever see her again.
Well, I want to hear about some of those, but let's talk about where they sent you and how you got there. From the U.S., it's a long way to that part of the world.
We embarked from Florida down across the Caribbean to Trinidad and over to Natal, Brazil. From Natal, we hopped over to Ascension Island, to Africa, and across Africa to India. It took us about 2 weeks from the U.S.
So you actually flew a B-24?
I was a co-pilot in a B-24.
But that's how you got there?
Yeah.
Because some guys would have been taken by ship or some crews taken another way.
Yeah.
And did you have the crew that you were going to be flying your missions with?
No.
Not yet.
As I say, I was a co-pilot on that trip. From Natal to Ascension Island was about 8 hours flight time. as we got close to the Ascension Island, it was the only land in the whole South Atlantic. If we missed that, we were swimming a long way. But I remember as we were approaching the end of our fuel endurance, thinking back, we had low-frequency radios that we had 50, 60-mile range. What if we miss that little island? Well, we're going to get wet. And one of the crew members voiced that concern. He was quite a religious young man and had his Bible in hand, and he handed it up to me, and he says, Lieutenant, if we miss Ascension, you want to read this? You want to read the Bible? I said, no. When we get to our ETA, estimated time of arrival, when we get to ETA, hand it back to me. I'll read it then. But we've made the contact with Ascension, and it was an RAF base. We refueled and stayed there for 2 to 3 days for mechanical something and went on to Dakar in Africa.
And then on to India from there?
Yeah, all across Africa to Karachi, and Karachi to the far northeast corner of India, Jorhat, which now is a huge city.
What'd you find when you got there in 1944?
It was a strip, a runway, a little over 3,000 feet, hacked out of the jungle, just one way in, one direction.
Regardless of what the wind's doing.
Didn't make any difference what the wind's doing. You got to be on one end of the strip or the other to take off.
And that's where you would fly all your missions from there?
All of them.
Uh-huh, all 78. Were you nervous at all before the first one?
I was anxious and wondered what we would find. I don't remember that first one. I was co-pilot for the first 6 or 8, and then went through B-24 training, and then I was a head dog in the aircraft from then on.
How much did you know the guys in your crew?
Intimately with the regular crew members. And I gained confidence in their ability to do their assigned position, and they grew to trust me at the controls. They'd go through hell with me, and did.
It's break time, but you can bet we're going to find out what he means by that when we come back. In the meantime, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos of Dr. Russell Brookshire then and now. There's a Christmas story coming that I don't think you've ever heard before. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit in Hanford, California with 97-year-old Dr. Russell Brookshire. Originally from Burke Burnett, Texas, he spent nearly a year in India in World War II, flying 78 missions in B-24 Liberators for the 1330th Army Air Force Base Unit out of Jorhat, India. One trip he made to Kunming was delivering top-secret cargo that he still doesn't know the details or significance of 75 years later. Maybe there's a future development there. And in general, anti-aircraft fire and enemy fighters would be challenging, I'm sure. But how about the weather you encountered there in India and when you flew your missions into China?
Sometimes the monsoon rainfall was 300 inches. Everything was flooded. Ceilings were from on the ground to 300 feet. Tops were 23,000 feet. I was so thankful that I've trained with the Royal Air Force because they were so intent on instruments, because the weather was so stinking over Britain. Oftentimes their instrument training was intense, and I, with that background, became an excellent instrument pilot. And my roommate and I, we flew some together, but just on special missions. But he was also trained with the RAF, and he and I were selected for extreme situations that required our instrument talents.
In other words, you guys were so good at instrument flying that they would entrust missions to you that would be more dangerous for a less experienced pilot.
Oh, yeah.
Instrument flying.
Yeah.
So you guys got the dangerous situation,
so to speak. And that caused some degree of belligerency. In fact, the operation officer would say, "Well, hell, Scoot." He called me Scooter. "Hell, Scoot, you did it again. Keep your mouth shut and you wouldn't get these things." So anyway, we were selected for many, many, many of the more delicate situations.
Well, I'd love for you to give us some examples of those, but maybe before that, since you just mentioned the nickname, where did that come from? When did they start calling you Scooter?
Well, Burton, Jasper Burton, my roommate, we were between flights, and we had gone into the little village that was near Jarhat, and it began to rain like crazy. Well, the British had a large unit there. They had a medium-sized military hospital, British staffed. Well, it began to rain. We were down there. We got ready to go back out to base. The rain had quieted a little bit. It was just misting, more or less. And Burton said, "Brooke, we just got a ride back to the base. There was a British motorcycle there." So we got aboard that motorcycle, and the base was 2.5 miles outside the city limits, village limits. And we got out there, rode the bike, and had it for about 2 days. We rode it around the base. And then one day, the colonel, CO of our base, called Bert and me in. He said to us, he said, "You guys just can't stay out of trouble." We didn't know what he was talking about. He says, "I understand you're riding the Queen's motorcycle." I looked at Bert. Bert looked at me and I thought, "Oh, crap, we've had it now." And so he dressed us up one side and down the other. And he was a pilot's pilot. He was mean is not the word. He was firm but fair. And we deserved every bit of it. And he said, "Now I want you guys to get on that motorcycle that Uncle Sam does not own. The Queen of England owns that motorcycle. You get on that bike and scoot the hell out of here." So he ended the confrontation with that. "Get on that, scoot the hell out of here." So the guys back on the base, of course, old Bert was 7 years older than I was. I was 21. He was the squadron trickster. He was always pulling something. He told everybody about our interview with Colonel Barksdale, commanding officer. And so they just picked up the, "Yeah, Brooke, old Scooter." Oh. And so the nickname stuck, and I was Scoot.
And you said a second ago that they picked you guys for the, I think you said, delicate missions. Can you give us some examples of what would make them so sensitive, what those missions were about and what they were like?
The General Tunner needed to go to Calcutta, which the air base at Calcutta was called Dum Dum. That was a big American base. The weather was stinking, and he had to be there for a meeting with Churchill. Colonel Barksdale called Bert and I in, and he said, "The meeting's at 10 o'clock. We're 4 hours, at least 4 hours. You better add another half hour to it from Calcutta." And he said, "You have to be there at 10 o'clock. The weather is terrible. You're to take the executive C-47 twin engine." It was airline fixed and all really plush inside. So he said, "You'll probably won't have any problem with the weather, with your ability, But you might have to slow down a lot and not bust through a bunch of this weather. And the general usually wants to ride co-pilot. He said, but I'll tell him, give him a weather rundown. It'd be best if he straps himself in the back. So that's exactly what happened. We got in the air about 6 o'clock. He says, you'll have to get up, have breakfast, hurry, and file your clearance, and be in the air by 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. We got in the air, and it was rougher than the roughest weather we'd seen.
So it's bouncing you around quite a bit?
Bounced us from 11,000 to 8,000. Fortunately, we were down in the river valley, the big wide Brahmaputra River, turns and goes south to Calcutta. We got down there and shot an instrument letdown. Ceilings were about 400, 500 feet, which was a piece of cake for us. We'd been subjected to ceilings almost on the ground, 200 feet or so. Wing tips, when we make the turn, would be no higher than 250 feet off the ground. But we got down there, General Tunner said, well, guys, that was one hell of a ride, but skillfully done.
That makes you stand up straight, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking at a story here about Christmas, 1944.
Oh, yeah. That was one that was published here in the paper.
You know, I've heard from some of those guys who were freezing their tails off the Battle of the Bulge that Christmas and thinking about what their families were doing back home. Looks like you had quite the experience that Christmas, too.
Yeah.
You were on a bombing mission with a bunch of other B-24s?
Yeah, returning.
Well, let's see what you can tell us here. I'll read some of what you wrote, and then you can fill in the rest for me. Your squadron was assigned a mission to deliver 12 500-pound bombs each in the bellies of 16 B-24s. Takeoff was 1,800 hours on the night of Christmas Eve, 24 December, to hit a large rail center at Xinchao in southern China. Altitude over target was 17,000 feet. Release and return to base 4 hours, approximately 1,000 miles. And you're right here, it was pitch black, and the planes were flying in loose formation with the only lights being the small formation low visibility blue lights on the wings. We were over target at approximately midnight. Enemy action had been light, and that's when things started. So your squadron was attacked by a night fighter group, and some of those B-24s got shot down. Help us understand what that's like for you, what you're experiencing in that cockpit when what sounds like a pretty calm situation turns chaotic.
At night, being attacked was sheer terror. You couldn't see them coming. You couldn't take evasive action. We were just sitting ducks.
Because you're 16 B-24s, but no fighter escort.
No fighter escort, yeah. In fact, we didn't have fighter escorts until the P-51s came in. They had the range tankage that would let them take us all the way to the target and return. Otherwise, if we did have a P-40 escort, it didn't have the range to take us all the way. So we were naked for the last probably hour to and from.
And it sounds like you're pretty naked in this situation. Midnight, pitch black. You don't know these fighter planes are in the area. And what's your first indication that something else is happening? You start hearing fire or you see explosions or what?
An aircraft over the parts of the route. I never could understand how they could pinpoint your altitude so accurately with their anti-aircraft shells bursting right in the midst of your formation. Occasionally would hit one of our aircraft and just explode in midair. And then the fire of the explosion diminished, of course, stopped, and you're in a total black again, wondering what's next.
And in this instance, you see immediately that, or maybe you're hearing on the radio, that two of those 16 planes are shot down right off the bat?
Yeah, read that whole sentence.
Yeah, I'll read it for you. Okay, it says, our squadron was attacked by a night fighter group who immediately downed two planes. We couldn't determine if any chutes were seen. Two more planes were hit and exploded with all crews aboard. Radio communication indicated that every American base in southern China was under red ball alert. The alert notices were yellow ball. That meant enemy aircraft was within 25 miles. Red ball alert indicated enemy aircraft was over the field and that the control tower was being abandoned and you were on your own. A number of the group was low on fuel and needed to refuel critically. It was either land or bail out, which many did. So some of the other B-24s in this group, if they weren't shot down, they decided they had to bail out if they were going to survive this mission. And you're dealing with that same kind of decision, and it's not just your life on the line. You've got your whole crew's lives on the line.
God, Paul, I don't know.
And you're a 21-year-old kid.
I'm living that all. I'm living that all again. We lost a lot of men. And you wonder, who's next? Us? But we always live for one more. There are no atheists in the skies of enough.
And that ultimately that decision on whether to try to land or whether to tell the whole crew to bail out and have each one of them exit before you do, that decision is on your shoulders, right?
Right.
Is there anything that prepares you for having to make that decision in that moment?
Guts. Realizing you're responsible for the guys aboard.
Did you ask them what they thought, or did you even have time?
No.
So something told you you can land this plane.
I knew I could land it if we could get there.
It says 7603 found an open field.
That's the tail number.
So is that your navigator who figured that out, or that's you?
Me.
Found the open field at Yumani, it says?
Yeah.
It says you landed under a yellow ball alert. There were many planes from bases all over China who were in the same conditions of low or no fuel. The base was totally dark. You landed and turned that plane, 7603, off the runway. Other planes landed wheels up, sliding in on their bellies, crew members jumping out and running as the field went red ball, because the Japanese planes are here now. Bombs are exploding around everybody, and there's direct hits from those Betty bombers. And it says you guys ran for the slit trenches for protection and stayed there the remainder of the night. You don't know what you're landing into. You don't know what's happening on the ground, and now these Japanese bombers are coming over. And
yeah, they were overhead. They were bombing the strip.
You made a fairly normal landing?
Yeah, and ran off the runway, tried to keep the runway clear.
Because you knew all these other planes needed somewhere to go.
So you'd land on the runway and run off into grass if there is grass.
So that plane comes to a stop, and your crew's already jumping out and running for it?
Oh, yeah.
What are you thinking when you exited that B-24?
Get the hell out of there. Get in the slit trench, because that was your only protection.
It says you stayed there the remainder of the night. So that's several hours. How long were the bombs still falling or machine gun fire still ringing out?
The field was under bombardment probably a total of a half hour. No telling how many bomb bursts there were during that time. Activity was probably not any longer than a half hour total.
How long did that feel like, though?
Years.
And I imagine that's probably not too different from how an infantryman in a foxhole feels when artillery's coming over or a bomber's flying overhead. What goes through your mind as you're huddled in that slit trench hoping the bomb doesn't fall too close to you?
Praying mostly.
Yeah?
Yeah, praying mostly and trying to keep warm.
Yeah, I left that detail out. It was 20 below zero?
Yeah.
And what do you have to keep you warm?
Leather flying suits. If you remain dry, they would wouldn't keep you warm, but they wouldn't let you freeze. And if you didn't have those, you'd freeze to death. And I'm sure there were some that didn't make it due to that 20-degree weather.
You could get killed by Japanese bombs. You can succumb to the weather. You're in the dark. It's Christmas morning. What a surreal Christmas. And somebody started singing?
Yeah, that gave a lot of people inspiration to make it through.
What were they singing?
Oh, Come All You Faithful, Silent Night, number of the old hymns.
So you hear a voice in the distance, and then another voice, and I'm just imagining this crescendo starts to build?
It did build up, yeah. And it seemed so peaceful at that time. And it gave people hope that there's going to be a tomorrow.
There's been a lot of Christmases since then. There's been 75 Christmases that you've lived through since that one. How often over all those years when Christmas rolls around do you reflect on Christmas 1944?
I don't know, a number of them. Mm-hmm. thankful that there has to be a God.
And all your crew survived?
Yes, all of the crew. Some of them were injured, but all survived. But we were scattered in the trenches, maybe just from here to the wall there, another trench, you know. But anyway, we were below ground level.
So when daylight came, is that when you guys started sorting things out?
Yeah, we got out. Actually, we began to get out, but it was still dark after the bombardment finished.
And you just mentioned some of your crew was injured, but your whole crew survived. But I'm sure over that day and the days that followed, it became clear to you how many other men on that mission in that group of 16 B-24s weren't going to go home to see wives or girlfriends or parents again. Was that the first time you really dealt with that reality of that kind of loss?
Yeah, that I had only been in the theater for about 3 months then, so I had another 8 months to go.
How does that affect you? A situation like that, does it make you more concerned the next time you fly that something like what happened to them happen to you?
I was able to put that behind and just look forward, just thinking, well, Lord has his reasons, but I don't know. So far, so good.
It's time for another break, but there's much more to come with 97-year-old Dr. Russell Brookshire of Hanford, California, including a mishap in the cockpit with one of his best friends, something he can laugh about 75 years later. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch with 97-year-old Dr. Russell Brookshire of Hanford, California. Scooter, as his friends called him in Jorhat, India during World War II, when he completed 78 missions in B-24s, earning the Distinguished Flying Cross, among other decorations. You know, you mentioned in there somewhere the anti-aircraft fire from the ground, how uncanny it was that they could pinpoint your altitude. And all the bomber pilots I've talked to have made it clear there's no evading that. I mean, you're in formation. You're going straight
to
the target.
And you don't see them coming until they burst at black.
So in those 78 missions, were there some of those where some of that flak hit your plane?
Oh, yeah. We had flak damage on a number of missions. Sometimes an aircraft burst seemed like they were so close together you could almost walk on them.
But you have to keep pressing right through it.
Right through.
Did you ever have any members of your crew that were hit, wounded by any of that?
Yes, we had flak wounds when a nearby burst would occur.
There's another story you wrote about here that you entitled, Just One More Time, Lord. The night was black, the moon was hidden above a 20,000 feet of thick monsoon clouds, rain limiting visibility to less than a half mile. My B-24 was the first in line for takeoff, the four mighty Pratt Whitney engines ticking over nicely. You're awaiting orders from the control tower to taxi into position to take off on runway 30. Cloud base was reported to be 400. The takeoff would be under instrument conditions. The order came to take the runway and was cleared for immediate departure to report on reaching altitude of 22,000 feet, and good luck. Second Lieutenant Brookshire, age 21, was at the controls, already a gifted plane commander. Co-pilot 26-year-old Raymond Adair, who was a newcomer and being trained to become aircraft commander of his own B-24 crew. Raymond was called Red for obvious reasons. Lieutenant Brookshire was called Scooter and had more than 20 missions behind him at this point. Scooter, this is you, aligned his aircraft on the runway and applied full power to the Pratt Whitney R-1830 engines. The plane lurched forward, accelerating rapidly to 125 miles per hour. Visibility limited forward vision to approximately two city blocks. The red lights at runway N were not visible. Runway marker lights were passing under the wings faster and faster. Finally, the red N lights came into view, and Red said, "Scoot, are we going to make it?" And Scooter replied, "Piece of cake." Was that really your mentality? Piece of cake? When the runway's almost out and you can barely see?
It was too late to do anything about it, but pull it off the... If it was ready to fly, we'd make it.
It says, just then, the big B-24 lifted off and was almost immediately in solid instrument conditions, flying totally blind. Scooter was uniquely qualified, having been trained in the Royal Air Force. Red, being a devout Catholic, crossed himself several times, pulled down his oxygen mask, required from ground up for night instrument flying, and settled down for a ride upstairs. Total instrument flying conditions continued through 17,000 feet, when B-24-7603 broke out into beautiful moonlit sky with stars like diamonds sparkling above. So that sounds pretty mundane, pretty peaceful. But it didn't end that way?
Well, you know, if no one was shooting at you, either anti-aircraft or fighters, it was a beautiful ride.
And it sounds like it stayed that way for about 3 hours. And then your tail gunner, whose nickname was Skinny, said, "Scooter, we have company, bandits 3 o'clock high." And there were six zeros cruising 3,000 feet above you, but now peeling off, diving on you. That sounds a little scary.
Yeah, it gets scary.
Does something change for you at the controls when you hear something like that?
No, not at that time, because it depends on what direction they're coming in at you. And there's really nothing you can do as they're coming in on you. You can't maneuver it. Information, so you're straight and level, so to speak. The zeros would come in with a burst, usually peel off, and come back up for another run at you. I was amazed at the accuracy and the ability of the Japanese pilots.
So just what you know about these kind of situations. At the time you're 21, you've flown about 20 missions. But what you know about that kind of scenario, the odds weren't necessarily in your favor, were they?
No, they were never in our favor, really, because they're going to do some damage coming through. If there's any kind of firepower coming out of them, you depend upon your gunners to get as many as you can.
And this says here that you're receiving fire, your tail gunner Skinny shot 1-0 down. Tracers are coming in. Every fifth shell's a tracer. Bill Stuffelfield on your right wing, his plane became a huge fireball. Didn't see any parachutes. That whole crew is gone. And you know that can happen to your crew in the next instant.
Yeah. We had self-sealing tanks. A shell could go through our tanks. They saved a lot of airplanes by that ability to take fire and not explode. But the Japanese did not have the self-sealing tanks. If the gunners hit one and happened to go through a tank, he was exploding or on fire.
Well, and it says that the B-24 on your left wing survived because of those self-sealing tanks, and their gunners kept firing, so that helped you guys out. Your crew chief in the top turret, Andy McKay, shot down another zero, so now there's three down, but there's still three zeros coming after you, and that's when a couple P-51s showed up?
Yeah, with a smile on our face.
That had to be a pretty good feeling to see those Mustangs arrive.
That's a reprieve.
So they shot, the P-51s took care of two more zeros, but there's still one more. I guess that one finally bailed on you, huh? Got scared away?
Yeah, boogered out.
But some of the debris from the plane that had exploded next to you had taken out your number four engine, so I left that part out. So you're down an engine, too, when those P-51s show up. So what would have happened if those P-51s didn't show up?
We'd have been one of those going down.
And you still had to bring that plane in.
On three engines, yeah. It slowed us down.
So you requested an emergency landing at Kunming. It says Scooter made his usual arrival, even on three engines. And then it says that you said something as you kissed the ground in Kunming. This says you muttered, "Just one more time, Lord."
It means thank you, Lord. Just one more time.
Did that contribute to your Distinguished Flying Cross?
No, I think that award was not from a particular situation. That was from several situations that were handled in an outstanding way.
You guys were also awarded the Presidential Unit Citation.
Right.
Must mean you guys did something significant over there.
All of us did something significant.
How would you explain the significance of what your bomb group did in all that time flying out of India?
I think our group put a star on our actions. I think there are a number of other plane captains did equally as well as I did.
How did you deal with losing some of those guys you knew, some of those other pilots and
like,
their crews?
Like losing one of the family, but there was no time to mourn. Activities went on, life went on.
Another thing I noticed there, in a couple of those, you know, anecdotes, your aircraft, your B-24, was referred to by that tail number, 7603. But then it looks like eventually you got to actually name a B-24.
Pensido.
That inspiration was back home in the States, huh?
Yeah. Pensido.
And did that get painted on the nose?
Yeah, and Japanese flags on the nose.
Were you able to take a picture of that and send it home to her?
You know, I've often wished I had kept a journal with pictures, but it was just another day of activity, you know. The corpsman woke you up at night, he got up, dressed, went down, got your operations orders, jeeped out, the crew gathered, went out to the revetment, got aboard, took off. 6, 7, 8 hours later, came back. Most of us came back. It was just a routine day, what we were there for.
Have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington?
Yes. In fact, Rusty and Anna went with me to the honor flight.
While you were there, while you're looking at that World War II memorial and all those gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who didn't make it home, what was going through your head?
I was proud to see the memorial and proud of our country for showing the honor that they held for all of us guys.
Did you find yourself reflecting on any of those guys you knew that those stars up there represented?
Yeah. Lots of friends, you know, 75 years ago. Names escaped me and forgotten, but I'm fortunate that the Lord has been so good to spare me for all these years.
It makes me wonder, when you're there at Jarhat, if you got back from a mission and there were guys that didn't make it back, or when you realized they weren't coming back, was there something you all did there on the base to honor their memory?
No, there wasn't. It was, okay, guys, on your feet, let's go.
What about when you found out that Japan had surrendered?
Well, I was on the taxiway to take off when the tower notified us that the Japanese had surrendered. Most of the air crews got out and firing their 45s and flare guns. It looked like 4th of July. Left the airplanes on the taxi strips on the end of the runway and all ended up at the club, the officers' club. There were more than a few drunks.
But it was probably a while yet before you got to come home and see your wife again, huh?
Yeah.
When did you finally get to return to the States?
Well, it was probably 6 weeks before we got back to the States, because transportation from the various areas over the world, we were fortunate that it only took 6 weeks or so to have transportation back.
And be honest with me. I'm not suggesting you haven't been honest. I know you have. But again, I'm just thinking, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. You're flying all these missions mostly before your 22nd birthday. I mean, you turned 22 just right before the Japanese surrendered. So you're a young guy. You've seen all these other planes shot down. You've come awfully close to that yourself, had to make emergency landings, had flak and fighters and weather. How many times, CBI, did you wonder, am I ever actually going to see my wife again?
You know, I'm not conscious of ever thinking that perhaps I wouldn't see her again, not knowing what the future held, but whatever it was, it had been good up to now.
Where did that confidence come from?
I don't know. I was honored, and I wondered why sometimes. Why did I get the Distinguished Flying Cross? Why did I get the Air Medal with Oak Leaf Cluster? Why did I get the Presidential Unit Citation? I didn't do anything but live day by day by day, do whatever we were trained to do. No, I have been honored all my life. In my marriage, 65 years, my kids, the Lord has been more than gracious.
So I've got to ask, what was it like to come back and see your wife again? Was that a happy reunion?
Oh, yeah. Like honeymoon all over.
And you stayed in the service. You stayed in the Army Air Corps until 1949, December of 1949. And you were flying C-54s, transports?
Loved it. I would have stayed in and made it as a career. But after World War II, there were so many pilots. They were decreasing the number. My name came up, and I was discharged. Not that I wanted to be, but I thought, okay, I'll take advantage of that and go back to college. So I flew Mets for 4 years. I had an opportunity to fly for Pan American stationed out of Bangkok with a great increase in salary. But I mulled that over about 15 minutes and said, no, I want to go home. I want to have an ice cream shake from the corner of an ice cream store. I just wanted to live as a civilian, and I wanted to be with my wife. Of course, she could have been with me at Bangkok, but that was not home, would never have been a home to me.
And what became your home right here in Hanford, California, sounds like a pretty unique way that you ended up here, because you go back to college, you go to medical school. Before you finished medical school, your wife found out about this community in Hanford. She was shopping for
that big bag,
the medical bag that you still have. She's shopping for a medical bag, and a gentleman tells her there's an opening for a doctor in Hanford.
A doctor was building it, had built several offices, and he had one vacancy left. He says, it's a nice little town, 9,000 people. Now it's, what, 60?
You practiced medicine here for 41 years. What was the significance of that for you? How fulfilling was that for you to be in this community and provide medical care for so many?
I enjoyed it. My patients were my friends. I delivered, took care of grandma and granddad, babies, and general practice I loved, because you took care of the whole family. And every Christmas, I'd go through the accounts receivable, those families that were hardworking, struggling families, wrote off their bills by the thousands of dollars worth.
What inspired you to do that?
Something that I wanted to do for them, for their trust in me, taking care of their families, putting their family's life in a lot of cases in my hands.
I'm not trying to make a connection that isn't there, but it just kind of hit me, and thinking about the story we heard earlier, here you're giving them an unexpected Christmas gift. Back on Christmas in 1944, the gift you got was just surviving, huh?
The gift I got for 78 measures was survival.
And now there's children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren who wouldn't be here if you didn't survive all those 78 missions.
Yeah.
Well, when you think back over that, 97 years old, you just had your 97th birthday. What would you say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Most proud of Pensy. My wife, my kids, all of them grown, families of their own, college educated, all of them. And with sadness, thinking about my younger son, a dentist.
You have any advice for young people who are thinking about a career in medicine today?
I have one grandson that just graduated last year as a podiatrist. He's the only one that has had any medical inclination. And he's doing his residency now in San Diego. But those that want to, I surely would encourage to continue.
Well, I asked you what you're most proud of looking back, but what about looking forward? Is there anything you haven't done yet that you're still hoping to check off that list?
You know, I'm interested in aviation. Got oodles of flying magazines, air and space, and I read every one of them from top to bottom, front to back. I just enjoy aviation activities.
Do you have to look up when you hear one of those Super Hornets from Lemoore?
Every time.
Yeah, you're really close to Lemoore Naval Air Station here in Central California. If there were an airworthy B-24 on the runway over there, you think you could take it off?
I think I could. Flying is just like walking to me, you know. It just sort of came natural.
I don't want to leave anything out if there's anything else important to you, but I do want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story that only you could tell us. I do have one more question for you, because it's been a long time since World War II, 75 years since they signed that surrender on the USS Missouri. Why does it still matter? What should all of us who weren't born yet know about what happened then and what all you guys did?
I'm embarrassed with what our country has become, the trend towards socialism. I wonder, don't they know? Don't the people know what that means? Our country's a jewel of the world. That flag is up there for a reason.
What does that flag represent for you?
Freedom. Freedom to live as you wish. Raise your family in peace. And I think We're just so fortunate to live under those circumstances. And I can't understand the thinking of people who want to change what we have.
I know we're running short on time, but maybe we can finish on a bit of a lighthearted note. Maybe it wasn't in the moment, but certainly all these years later. Was there really a mustache fire to put out in your cockpit?
Oh, Burton, my roommate over in India, as I told you, he was the squadron jokester. We were flying after put in about 70 missions. They allowed two plane commanders to fly. Otherwise, Burton and I both were sort of the introductory pilots, teaching the new pilot coming in how to fly a loaded, overloaded B-24. Anyway, Burton and I were flying together. He was a co-pilot in the co-pilot seat, and I was in pilot seat. And the oxygen system is two switches. One of them was a continuous flow of oxygen. The other one was on demand. As you breathed, the valve would open. We were cruising along, well, I don't know how high we were then, altitude probably 18, 20, 22,000 feet. Burton was over there sitting, oxygen mask on, all of us. He was a cigar smoker, and he stuck a cigar in his mouth, reached in his jacket pocket, pulled out his lighter, pulled the oxygen mask off of his face, stuck his cigar in his mouth, and flicked that Zippo lighter, and nothing but blue flame emitted from that. And he had a gay 90 type of mustache.
Handlebar?
A handlebar. He was so proud of it. He greased that thing and twisted, you know, and it's just a blue flame. And he pulled that off and just was slapping his face, and his it ended up his goggles were, you know, and it scared him half to death, scared everybody. The crew chief was sitting in the gunny seat right between us, scared the fool out of us. We laughed at Burton, and of course I had to tell it around over the base when we got back. That damn Brookshire spreading all those stories.
The true story of the time he burnt his mustache.
Yeah.
Huh? Did he have any of it left when he got the fire put out?
It was savagely rearranged. And one side was just ruined, and he had to shave it off.
If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a short video of Dr. Brookshire telling that story, complete with a photo of him and his friend Jasper Burton with a post-fire mustache. The podcast version of this episode online has a few memories that wouldn't fit into our radio time today, so you might enjoy that as well. Thanks to Dr. Tom Enlow for suggesting we visit with one of his medical predecessors in Hanford, California, and thanks most of all to Dr. Russell Brookshire of the 1330th Army Air Force Base Unit, 97 years young. That's all the time we have today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.